Blog Talk Radio.
I had to bring mom in on this one.
Anybody grateful for God's blood?
Tell them about it, man.
Oh, the blood that saved me, the blood that raised me, the blood that healed me.
Yes. Listen.
The blood that saved my life.
And thank you for the lamb.
Thank you for the lamb. Oh, the lamb that was sacrificed.
I'm so glad.
Hello, you're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Today, the interview is with someone who lives in Caprina Green. As you know, Mr. Ron Simmons, the former Olympian winner, is doing a fundraiser to raise money for Caprina Green to make a film about Caprina Green. It's the housing authorities or projects. I used to live in the housing projects also. We're going to talk about how decent the projects used to be, especially those in Caprina Green before drugs and things were planted. How are you doing, Mr. Kenneth?
No, it's Kinsey, Mr. Kinsey.
Mr. Kinsey.
I'm doing fine, and it's Caprina Green. It's got an E sound, Caprina Green.
Caprina Green.
Yeah, Caprina Green. Yeah,
yes,
I'm doing fantastic over here in Chicago.
I mean, you used to live in Caprina Green.
I grew up there.
And I used to live in the projects also. The projects were not always the better. The projects used to be a step up.
Right.
I think they did this all over America, not just in Caprina Green, because a lot of black people lived in the housing authorities.
Right.
Yeah, so tell me about Caprina Green.
Well, Caprina Green was, I grew up on, I was born on the west side, but at the age of five or six, we moved to Caprina Green. And in Caprina Green, I mean, it was beautiful, tall, red brick buildings, grass everywhere, lots of places for the children to play. I mean, it was a beautiful place, and the building was full of families. It wasn't just single women without men. Men were there. They had husbands and boyfriends that they lived with, and they had jobs. All these guys were working. And the people who wanted to break all this up, they made decisions on what they had to do to tear it all up. And so that's how the men ended up out of the family. You know, the women ended up without men. They had to keep the men on the outside. But before all of that happened, it was a place where there was happiness. I mean, people used to sleep outside. You know how sometimes in the summertime you would be out in the front of the building just listening to some music and the kids are playing peacefully. Sometimes you could just lay out there and sleep and just lay back and relax and sleep all night, you know? It was like that. It was flowers along the grass up against the wall. You had flowers growing, playgrounds where the children played peacefully. But the thing about it is when we moved in, there was a group of white people who didn't like the idea that they had put blacks in that property that was really right on the Gold Coast. For those who don't know, the Gold Coast was like the richest neighborhood in Chicago. And so we were like right on the Gold Coast. I mean, we get up and just take a little short walk the dog. We're on the Gold Coast that fast. And, you know, they didn't like that. They knew that they wanted that territory. They didn't even want those buildings built. And after the building was built, you know, they were just figuring out every way, everything that they could do to get blacks out of there. But it was, you know, people played basketball, they played baseball. And like you said, Ron Simmons was in the weightlifting. He went and won a gold medal, you know. Me, myself, I started my movie career in Cabrini-Green. When they made, you know, a guy, there was a guy named Eric Monte who lived in Cabrini-Green. He made a TV show called Good Times. Now, he's straight out of Cabrini-Green. He made, like, what for modern-day people, you know, that was like the first black TV show. Came up out of Cabrini-Green, Good Times. That same brother, Eric Monte, he came back again with the first black movie, you know, for modern days. He made Cooley High. All that came up out of Cabrini-Green. All of the, you know, the entertainers, and but other than entertainers like Curtis Mayfield, Major Lance, The Impressions, Ramsey Lewis, and what's his name, Earth, Wind & Fire founder, Maurice White. You know, he was playing with Ramsey Lewis. So it's like all of that energy came out of Cabrini-Green.
What all did you act in?
I wasn't acting. I was working behind the scenes on Cooley High. But I went from working on Cooley High, I worked on Mahogany. A lot of the stuff that you don't see, the stuff, you know, when a movie's being made, it's like 1,000 people working on that movie. You just see the actors. But other than the actors, there's like 1,000 people running around doing different things. Most of the stuff that you saw in Mahogany, I was responsible for, you know. But I'm talking about the stuff, not the people, the stuff that you see. The clothing that they're wearing, you know, the rooms that they in, you know, I decided what a lot of those rooms look like, or what the walls were going to look like, or whether it was going to be some napkins laying there, a cigarette butt or whatever. I did a lot of that in Mahogany. That was my job. You know, I went from there, I worked on another movie called The Monkey Hustle. I was the assistant art director on that, doing the same thing. Dressing the sets, doing the art direction, you know, but after that, it was like so much racism, but they'd go out of, just like they went out of their way to put black people, destroying the projects and putting black people out. They also were doing the same thing as far as jobs. Whites didn't want me working on movies, and I would be working, and I had to put up with people calling me a nigger. But that didn't stop me from working. I say this nigga's gonna tell you what to do, and you're gonna do it, or you're gonna be out of, you're gonna be out of a job. But I left Chicago because of the racism. I headed for the West Coast. I stayed out there. I worked out there. But after being gone for like maybe a little over a decade, I came back, bounced around to D.C., then I came back to Chicago. You know, during those years, that's when I ended up meeting up with Ron Simmons. But it wasn't just me. There were so many people that came out of Cabrini-Green that was doing positive things. And I'm talking about people that the job that they got might not seem important, you know, because he's just driving a bus or he's just working in the factory. These were good people working jobs, whatever the job they could get, they were working jobs and nice people. Everybody was like family. If you were outside playing and you did something wrong, people that weren't even related to you would check you. They might whoop your butt before your mama get home, you know? It was a nice place, a beautiful place, but they never tell you about that. They keep that a secret. It was a beautiful place until they brought in all the guns and the drugs. They brought that stuff in. Blacks don't grow no cocaine. Blacks don't know nothing about making cocaine and heroin. You know, all of that stuff was brought in, shipped in to the black communities to help destroy the black communities. Am I right?
You are right. That
is
that about the drugs in. They have meth now. They have crack cocaine. They have all that.
Right.
And they did it to destroy black people.
And right now they're doing the same thing with the food. They're doing the same thing to the food right now. It's like when we grew up, the food that we were eating was like food that came from the ground. And now they put all the farmers out of work, and the government is pushing all the food now.
Yeah.
They're deciding what we're going to eat. And they're going as far as putting stuff in the food. You know, that GMO stuff, you know, I can't stand it. I don't know what to eat anymore. It's gotten to the point where it's hard to find food that the government hasn't touched. I keep seeing on the internet, they're talking about how what the food that they're putting out there, they keep talking about the negative stuff that it's doing to your body, you know? The way it's causing diseases and everything. I don't know nothing about cooking, so it's rough for me because I got to deal with somebody else cooking all the time. And usually people cooking, they don't know about this type of stuff, so they end up buying fruits and vegetables that have been touched by the government. You know, I stopped eating pig. My father stopped me from eating pig when I was a teenager, and one day a young lady told me, she said, you know, they got pork and tomatoes. And that freaked me out. She said, I'm not lying. She said, Google it. And I found out they were putting pork in the tomatoes to make the skin on the tomatoes tougher, you know?
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, that way the tomato will have longer shelf life. Because, you know, normal tomato, they can get beat up kind of quick because they're so soft. But now they got tomatoes where you can toss them around and they're not going to even bust because they're hard. That's because they partly made from a pig. Got that tough pig skin. I think that's the same thing they use to make baseball. So that's the world that we live in. And I'm glad that you're doing a project like this because I get tired of people only knowing about one side of Cabrini Green. They go by what whites have put on the news. They're always putting on the news talking about those bad criminals from Cabrini Green. No, we weren't bad criminals. We were good everyday people, and we all wanted to raise our families and, you know, and do something good for the world. But they changed all that.
Okay.
Everything they did, they put it on the news and made it look like we did it, you know?
Yeah, and racism. And now Cabrini Green is considered, well, at one time was considered one of the worst neighborhoods, but the white people did that.
Right. And right now, yeah, they said back then, if you looked on the news and the newspaper, they would say that Cabrini Green was like the most dangerous place in America. You know, but by saying that over and over again, it just made it. It made it seem like blacks did that. But that was just propaganda. That's just words that they put out. They made those words up and kept saying it over and over again to the point where everybody believed it. And then you got to understand that when you don't have anything else, but crime, you begin to want to be the best criminal, you know? You want to be the top criminal. They pushed a lot of brothers into crime by not allowing them to get good work. I mean, because if you can't get good work to take care of your family, you're gonna take the only job that's available to you. And there's always somebody willing to hire you to sell drugs. And when you see how much money you can make quickly in one day, you know, it's hard to stop selling drugs. But they created that thing. They kept us from becoming employees and owning homes and everything. They even miseducated us, you know.
They miseducated us. They discriminated against us. Racism is rampant.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to, when I came out of high school, I went to Cooley High for 7th and 8th grade. And when I made it to high school, I went to Waller High School. Most people who lived in Cabrini went to Waller High School, Cooley High, or Wells. Those were the closest high schools. Waller, Cooley, and Wells. Unless you went to like a Catholic school. But I didn't go to Cooley because that was a vocational place where you learn trade. When I look back on it, I figure I made a mistake because everything I learned at Waller didn't do me any good in my life. I didn't get jack shit out of Waller at all, okay? Now, I went in with art skills. Everybody that met me told me you'll never have to work in your life because you're too good of an artist. You're an artist. You know, you're going to end up working for Walt Disney or the movie industry or somewhere. That's what everybody kept telling me. But that school, they didn't even nurture my skills, you know. I didn't get nothing out of that school. I wish that I had went to Cooley and learned how to build an automobile, learned how to do electricity, wood, or a print shop, you know. I wish I had went there because I never got any skills because the only skills I had was art. But that's what got me into the movie world. But I just happened to fall into that because they were making a movie in my neighborhood. And by them making a movie in my neighborhood, I was able to jump into it because I had just learned how to make TV commercials. I went to a school for making television commercials and print ads. So as a advertising art director, I learned I learned how to make 60-second television commercials, 60-second and 30-second. That's like very short movies. So I figured if I'm an advertising art director, I should be able to work on a movie because a movie is nothing but a long commercial. That's how I saw it. So I talked to the art director, tried to get him to let me in to work with him. I was already working on the movie, you know, doing extra work and a few other things. But I was trying to work with the art director. He told me he would get me a job, hook me up on something else that was coming to town. That's how I ended up working on other stuff. But that was really interesting. Cause,
you worked on Mahogany, Good Times?
No, I didn't work on Good Times. I just worked on Mahogany and Cooley High and the Monkey Hustle. And later on, after I came back from California, I worked on the U.S. Marshal with Wesley Snipes and Tommy Lee Jones and the Gladiator, Cuba Gooding, and a few other things. But the racism is so strong that, and then there's the thing about age. It's like now it's it's like everything is run by young people, and it's harder for an older person to even get through the door on anything. So, and right now I'm 73 years old, and I had to decide like 10, 15 years ago, I said, I have to make my own movie because nobody's giving me a job.
So what kind of movie did you make?
No, I started writing. I started writing and writing and writing. And so I got some things that I'm working on writing, but it's like, it's hard. It's a hard road, you know. It's got to be something that you really love to do it, because if you don't have the love and the passion for it, you're not going to do it. I tell people all the time, you got to find out what you love doing. You can do it. It's best to be an entrepreneur and own the business that you're working for. Because if you're working for somebody, you're never going to get nowhere. You know, they held back on jobs, but the truth is people came out better when they just created their own job, you know? When you create your own job, you're the boss. You can get off when you feel like getting off. You know, when you're working for somebody else, you're making that person rich, not yourself.
Entrepreneurship is better.
Right.
Entrepreneurship is better, but you have to have some business with entrepreneurship, or you'll be like my show, because I don't make hardly any money at my show. So, you know, I can't really support myself with the show. So
yeah.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I got the ceiling fan on. I have to do other things with my show.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I do, me, myself, I do multiple things, you know. I mean, I'm a filmmaker, but I also, I paint signs. I mean, I do art. I do all types of artwork. I've got artwork in the museum downtown, the Art Institute of Chicago. They purchased maybe 9 or 10 paintings from me.
That's good.
And also, I've got artwork in the African American Smithsonian in D.C.
Oh wow!
I did a airbrush leather outfit. I was working with a friend of mine. Her name is Gloria Lowry. She cut the piece. She originally designed the piece, and then she brought me in, and I assisted her and made some changes. And I painted the outfit totally. And it was for Braille Advertising was doing this project for Canadian Mist. That alcohol, Canadian Mist. And so they had a fashion show. It was like fashions for misting. And I guess misting is drinking their alcohol. You misting when you're drinking some Canadian Mist. So it was futuristic fashions for misting. They did a show. And so they had people make these outfits, and we were chosen to be a part of this. So we did this outfit for that fashion show. And after they finished with the outfit, they sent us some money, and they told us that the outfit would be on permanent the Black Fashion Museum in Harlem, which was owned by a woman named Lois Alexander Lane. She owned the Black Fashion Museum of Harlem. She died in 2007, and they her daughter wanted to get rid of the museum and put it in somebody else's hands because, you know, running a museum can be a lot of work. So the Smithsonian decided to take it. And so everything that was in Lois Alexander's museum went to the Smithsonian. So that's how our fashion piece ended up in the Smithsonian, you know?
Oh, okay.
But right now, that's all I got is stories. I ain't got no money, you know.
Okay.
I done done some everything. I've been some everywhere, you know. They got Bob Marley's movie out now, and I'm wondering, am I seen in the movie? Because I was always around Bob Marley when he was in California, you know. Even though I know it's a film that they use actors to play all the parts, but sometimes when they're doing a movie like that, they have certain clips where you might see the real Bob Marley on stage, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of times when they're making movies, they will use some
real Marley film.
You saw it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I said, I hope when I see it, that there's a scene where they got the real Bob Marley and I can see myself on the stage. That would be nice. But I've been a lot of places, done a little things, a lot of things, and I always say that I give credit. Most of what I do, it all started in Cabrini Green. Cabrini Green was a powerful place. And we learned a lot, you know. I became a man in Cabrini Green. It was a janitor in Cabrini Green that told me to the streets, you know. Yeah, he told me get out the streets. He said, "Cause you're gonna get killed out here." And he advised me. He sat me down and talked to me. He knew I was running the streets real tough. He talked to me, and what he said to me touched me. I went and got in school. That's how I learned. That's how I became an advertising art director. Because
Okay. Because
he told me to go to school, and that's what I did. I went to Malcolm X College. And that introduced me really to art. You know, I was always could draw, but I wasn't what I call myself an artist, you know. I wasn't painting pictures and all that kind of stuff. Once I went to Malcolm X College, that's when I started painting on canvas and everything, you know.
Oh, okay.
And they found me at Malcolm X and asked me. They asked not just me, they asked a bunch of us if we were interested in being involved in advertising because advertising had been all white. And the blacks in advertising were complaining. And I guess they had said, well, you know, can we have some black commercials if we can get more black people involved? You know, I don't know how it started, but they came looking for us. And they pulled me in. And that's how I got where I'm at. That's how I started. That's what made me think I can make a movie because I learned how to make TV commercials.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you were able to support yourself.
Yeah, well, I've always been able to support myself because I'm multi-skilled. You know, it's like I always had the ability to be broke and just walk in a bar and ask, you know, I could pick up some flyers off the table in the bar or flyers from anywhere and walk off with a bunch of the flyers and go in a bar and start drawing people for a few dollars, you know?
Okay.
As long as you can draw, or pretend you can draw, you can make money. Because it really doesn't matter what the picture looks like, okay? As long as you say, I'm drawing you, okay? sit there. I got you. You know, just be still. Move a little bit, but, you know, just kind of stay in the same position. As long as you talk like that, talk like you know what you're doing, it don't matter what the picture look like, they're going to accept it as art, okay? And I know that because one of my best friends, when I met him, he couldn't draw a lick. But he had been on Wells Street. He'd been walking them down Wells and North Avenue making money. And when I said, let me see your sketchbook, he could not even draw. But the key was he thought he could draw.
Oh, okay. He thought he could.
Oh. If you think you can and you're acting like artists and you're doing it, they accept what you did.
They accept what you did. That's right.
Right. So he thought he good. I taught him how to draw. I took him under my wing. And at that time, I was just passing through Chicago. I was going back to L.A. And when I went back to L.A., he came with me. And I taught him how to draw. Because I was teaching him every day. We'd be out in the street drawing, and he got better. He got so good that one day I went out in the streets, and when I came back, when I walked in the house, he held up one of my pictures. He held it up, and from a distance, he ripped it. He ripped my picture in half, and I charged over there after him, you know. And before I could get to him, he said, that's not your picture. He said, that wasn't your picture. That was mine. I copied yours. He pointed to mine. He said that.
So Corinna Green really was a great place to stay.
Yes. Yes, it was a beautiful place to stay. You know, I tell people all the time, I said, we could walk to Oak Street Beach. All of that is prime territory in Chicago. That was our beach, Oak Street Beach. North Avenue Beach, that was all our neighborhood, you know? There was only a L track separating poverty from the rich folks. An L that ran along right near where Well Street. Once you went up under that L, you started seeing things that cost money. So, it was a short walking from Cabrini Green up into Rush Street, you know, a short walk. So that meant that people had jobs on Rush Street. You know, as kids, as you growing up and you get to that age where your mama tell you got to go get a job somewhere, people were getting jobs up on Rush Street and down in Old Town. That's where all the work was at. So remember, all the jobs that the men had had previously, they closed up all those factories where the men were working at. They closed up all the factories. When they decided they was going to destroy Cabrini Green, that's what they did. They shut down all the factories, and the guys had, and they shipped those factories like overseas and places like that where they could get that same labor done for a dollar or less. Yeah, you imagine you paying somebody $5 or $6 an hour, but they tell you
they deliver, ship them overseas.
Yeah, because they can go over there and get people work for 2 cents an hour. You know, well, work would be so cheap. You know, they could pay the cost of when you know what they paid workers. I'm talking about all the workers in the building. Probably for just a handful of them, that would cover the whole factory overseas, you know? They came out on top by the ship overseas, but it destroyed the city. It put so many people out of work. It made you have to, either you had to get to begging or hustling or something. Me, I went straight to the streets. I love the streets. Okay, so it didn't affect me like it affect so many other people because I knew how to make money. I could draw people. I could paint a sign, you know. I had the skill to paint. I always had the skill to paint signs and to draw people.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah, so that's what kept me safe, you know. Kept me from having to sell drugs and stuff.
I understand.
But I tell people all the time, everybody didn't have those type of skills. A lot of people, it's like their level of intelligence, they needed to have a regular job. They didn't know how to, you know, it's like a person like me. I knew I could do anything. I can be an actor. I can be a writer. You know, I can be a talk show host. Whatever I want to do, I know I can do it because I just think like that. But most people, most people don't think like that. They don't just grow up thinking, I can be a pilot or astronaut. I don't know why, but I always thought I could do anything I wanted to do.
Yes.
And so I didn't have no problem surviving. But I can't wait for Ron to get his movie made.
Did you say that the gentleman who made Good Times came out of Cabrini Green?
Yes, he did. He came right out. You know, we had the red buildings, the white buildings, and we had the row houses. The red buildings were tall buildings. The white buildings were tall buildings. But the row houses were the original buildings that were built. They were like just two-story. And they call them the row houses. I grew up on Oak Street. And the red buildings were on the north side of Oak Street. And between Larrabee and Hudson, you had those two-story buildings called the row houses. That was on the south side of Oak Street. And it ran from Oak Street, I think, almost up to Chicago Avenue.
Okay.
Some short, great, the same buildings. If you're watching Cooley High, and in Cooley High, when Preach goes home, he climbs up into the window trying to sneak into the house. Those are the row houses. I think that's where Eric Monty lives at. I know that somebody told me Curtis Mayfield lived up in there, too. Yeah, Row House, they had a lot of talent came up out of there. There was talent all over that area, you know. I always say there was more people talented in that area than, you know what I'm saying, if you took that area, they say it's 70 acres. So I always say, you can take 70 acres in any city. I say, nobody has 70 acres that delivered as strong as we did. You know?
Curtis Mayfield lived near Cabrini Green.
Yeah. He lived in the Cabrini Green. Not near it, in it.
He lived in it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so many people lived in it. You know, the list is long. But the thing about it, it's in the people with names that you don't know. You know, names that you don't know. Those people were beautiful people. They were good people. And they led good lives. I mean, they're people that you'd be glad to have them as a neighbor, you know? You know, it was after the white folks were successful in destroying the project, that's when shit went buck wild, okay? Where it was like nobody up in there but criminals. You know, you had a I heard that they had some good people in there that didn't nobody bother them because they knew them. But I heard it was just crazy gangs, drug gangs, just took over everything. And nobody would come up in there. But like I said, that was all after I was gone. It was gangs there while I was there, but I mean, it wasn't like what it turned into. They told me that you could run from one apartment to another one because they had holes in the wall, you know?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was like, and they had turned off all the services, you know? It's like they created something like hell. But that's what you do. That's what happens when you force people into poverty. You know, you force them into poverty and you give them drugs to sell.
And then you pass the laws.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. And at the same time, they did what they always did. They created laws. They put you in a situation where you got to break the law. And then they create laws where they can lock you up and keep you in jail. And then they, instead of you opening up a factory overseas, you can open up a factory right here in Illinois. Open your factory inside of a penitentiary, you know? And you get people enslaved within the penitentiaries. They're back on the slave plantation. Because that's what, you know, when they signed that paperwork saying they were ending slavery, it said it except for when they're in jail, you know. It said that it's okay to enslave people when they're incarcerated. And that's what they started doing. They started locking everybody up for all kind of small crimes. I myself got locked up. I got sent to jail for having one stick of weed, you know. And now marijuana is legal, but they locked me up for having one joint in my pocket. Took me to jail and sweated me all night like, you know, like I was the kingpin or something. sweated me, wanted to know where all the rest of the weed was at and shit. And all I got is one joint. I'm like, I don't even really, didn't even smoke weed. I just had that one joint. But they treated me coldly for that one joint. They just treat me bad. They stomped me while I was in jail, you know, down there.
Why do they abuse? Why are they so violent and abusive? And they taught it to black people.
Right.
Black to abuse black women. Because over in Africa, we were queens and kings.
Right.
You know, over here, they try to turn us into animals.
Well, I think that's all they know. I think they have always been violent people. I think they were always violent people, animalistic, you know. I think black people were always people that were full of love. But I've had them beat the hell out of me at the Cook County Jail for no reason. I hadn't did anything to get beat up, but I got stomped. That's the way it is. If you're black in America, you're treated as the enemy, and you will always be treated as the enemy. And they will always be the one who owns the TV station and so they tell the news. They're going to always tell the news in a way to make blacks look like they are nothing but criminals when they're actually the one that's committing the crimes. You know?
The white people.
Yeah, they're constantly murdering everybody. locking up everybody. You know, everybody we had as an entertainer, they beginning to kill them or lock them up, you know. They locked Bill Cosby up for some stuff that they have been doing since the beginning of time, you know. But he was black, and they wanted to bring him down from where he was at. I think they said he was trying to buy NBC or something, and they just took him all the way out, locked him straight up.
I think it was CBS.
Yeah, they claimed that he was giving women drugs and having sex with them, okay? And I said, ain't that what people been doing the entire time I've been living? You know, I've always seen people trying to get a woman drunk or just trying to get her high because then she may say yes. You know, it'd be easier. Now, I've never done it because I've always prided myself on my conversation. You know, if it's a woman that I want and she's sitting there listening to me, I'll talk her into it. I don't have to get her high. You know, I've said it a million times. I have never gave a woman a drink. Never in my life. I don't like alcohol, and I don't give it to a woman. If a woman got some alcohol, it's because she bought it. I don't even want to buy it for nobody. I don't drink.
You don't drink.
But all my life, I've seen, I know that that's something that will loosen a person up, and they might do things they don't normally do. It's like I just watched the guy 2 days ago at a birthday party. He came in the door. He was the life of the party. He came in dancing, and he got right into it, jumping on the floor, started dancing, and he was bringing other people to the floor. And I said, man, you a hell of a guy. You the life of the party. But his cousin told me he's not really like that. He told me he's a quiet guy. And when he get out, once he get alcohol in him, he turns into that. I said, but that's got to be the real him. If he turn into it, usually you turn into yourself. At least that's what I hear. You know, you do what you really, who you really are, you know, when you're drinking. That's what I heard. You say what you really want to say. So, But I've never given alcohol to a woman. But there were a few women that I really liked, and I said, maybe I should have gave them some alcohol.
Oh, no,
and they,
no,
and they,
no,
I'm,
no,
I'm,
no,
not,
no.
But I'm not saying where you give somebody some alcohol to take advantage of them, but where they might feel like, let's do this. That's what I'm saying. But not to, I would never, see, I've been with guys that would give people alcohol and just to get them at a certain level with the alcohol, then they would put them in the car and turn the heat all the way up till they pass out just so they could rob them, okay? I knew guys that would do that. They would get another guy, they'd get him high, and then put him in the car, turn the heat all the way up, until he passed out, and then take everything he had on him. That was something I seen, okay?
Okay.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people that would do that to a woman, okay? But I'm saying I wouldn't do nobody like that, never. I was the guy that if I wanted your money, I could talk to you and you would give me your money. Because like I say, I had conversations. You know, I had conversation, and if I wanted the pretty woman, they followed me because I had the conversation to make them want to go with me, you know. If I knew you had a bankroll and I wanted that $1,000 that you got, I knew what to say to you to make you smile and hand me that $1,000. That was my personality and that was my skill, you know. So I never had to pull a gun on nobody or get nobody drunk to do anything negative. Only thing I ever wanted from people was some money. And yes, I did talk to them and make them want to be a part of whatever I was doing. It's funny, though. That skill goes right out the window when it comes to making a movie. You know?
Yeah, I understand.
It's hard to get people to want to do anything, you know?
Yeah.
Things have changed a lot now. It's hard to get the people to want to get involved to do anything. But in my days and time in Cabrini Green, it was a beautiful place, and I was there. I was there when it turned rough, you know. I was there when it turned rough, and like I say, dude saved me. He said, "I want you to get out of here. Get out of here. You know, you need to be gone. You got too many skills." And I wasn't the type of person who didn't listen, you know. I left. I went to Malcolm X. Went from Malcolm X to being a commercial art director. Next thing you know, I was living in Hollywood, making TV shows. You know?
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
You had a fantastic career. Cabrini Green sounds like a fantastic place.
It was a beautiful place. That's why I can't wait for Ron Simmons to get his movie or a TV show, whichever way he go. I can't wait for him to get it out there because Ron Simmons, he knows how beautiful it was. He knows about the feast and all the other good stuff that we experienced. The feast was like a magical time in the summertime when the Italians would open up Larrabee Street and with all kind of, it's like all the traffic would be shut down and they would have a bunch of booths where they would have rides, you know, like carnival rides and booths where you can play games and you can win prizes. Oh, man. And it was called the Feast. And they would have this woman on a float and they would parade through there. On a certain day, they'd have a woman. She'd be dressed like some type of angel or something. And everybody would be wanting to touch her or touch the float, and they'd be putting money up there. Looked like it'd be thousands of dollars be tossed up on that float, you know. It was some type of religious stuff. I don't know. Some Italians. Something in the Italian religion. But they would set it off. That was the time of the feast. That was like the best time of the summer when they had the feast. Then I guess when the projects got so wild, just went buck wild, probably why they stopped the feast from coming and they moved the feast. The Italians moved that feast somewhere else. But, you know, Cabrini Green was built on bad territory. When you think about how bad Cabrini Green, it was bad when I left. When I left, I used to have to dodge bullets just going from my building to get to the air, okay? But I wasn't actually dodging bullets. I was dodging all the people that I knew that would shoot at me, you know? So I'm sneaking through there because I got to get to the air, you know, so I can get back to the west side because I had moved to the west side. So it had turned wild, but it got super wild after I was on my path into the art and film and stuff. It got super wild that where it was really looked at like this big hellhole. But But the truth is, before we were even there, before they built those red projects, that was an Italian neighborhood. I think it was might have been Italian and Irish, but white folks had that neighborhood, and they called it Little Hell. Little Hell, and they said it was people would get murdered right down the corner of like Oak Street and Orleans, something like that. People get murdered there in the daytime on a regular basis. They say it was the roughest territory in Chicago. And yeah. that's before the projects got built.
That was before the projects got built. Lord have mercy.
Yeah, right. See, when Little Hill was there, I think that was the birth of the Chicago mob, you know? Because it was nothing but criminal action there. All kind of criminal action. Mob violence and shit. All up in there. It's the territory where Cabrini Green sat. It sat on, you know, they took those buildings, they put the projects on top of those buildings, okay?
But they did all across America.
Yeah. Yeah.
All across America.
Right.
What the project?
They sure did. And the interesting thing, we were driving down the street last week, and I took out, I just thought about it all of a sudden. I said, I got to make a Facebook post. I said, we had high rises, and they took them from us. They destroyed them so they could tear them down and replace them with white projects. I'm talking about projects for white people. Because I said, look, they got the same high rises, but it's all white people with jobs, you know?
And the black people had jobs in Cabrini Green.
Yes. Everybody had jobs. Everybody had a hard-working man. Whether it mattered or not, they had a hard-working man. They had fathers. Those children had fathers. But they took all of that away. They took it all away. And made up lies.
All right. So we're going to... You can keep talking. Show Talk with Angela Butler will continue another 15 minutes.
Yeah, so that's just the world we live in, though. You know, we can't control what white people do, but we can control ourselves. You know, so it's up to us to start loving each other and respecting each other.
Loving each other, respecting each other, yes.
Yes, and respecting your homes and your block, your neighborhood, instead of wanting to kill each other just because you live on the other side of the track, y'all shooting and killing each other. That shit don't make no sense. They're trying to keep us doing stuff like that, you know? Got to stop wanting to be famous for killing people, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
That's what's happening right now. They got you wanting to be famous for the number of people that you done murdered. It ain't about that. You got to start doing like other people and building yourself a business, you know, building yourself a legacy. Because whatever you want to do, you can do it. You just got to try. Can't just give up. You can't just give up because somebody else fired you, you know, took your home away from you. You can always get another home. You can always start over.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, isn't it? You know, I know what that's like because when I was doing all of that artwork and making all that money and living a great life, I lost everything. I lost everything. I mean, they set me up and made me look like a criminal when I wasn't breaking any laws.
And that never made any sense, to set somebody up.
Yeah, that's what they do. They do it to politicians all the time. A politician that they want him to be out the pitch and get rid of him, they'll lie on him and say all types of stuff just to get rid of him. Where nobody will respect him anymore. He can't run for office because all they think about is the story that they heard.
But Donald Trump is running for office.
Yeah, but that. They lied on me and got destroyed my whole life. So I'm in the process of coming back.
Is feeling you like black people?
Yeah, but to me, it doesn't matter who's in office. It could be a Republican, a Democrat. It could be Donald Trump, Biden, anybody. None of them are going to support black people.
Really not.
We got to start supporting ourselves and unifying, because if we don't unify, there will be no future for us at all. If we don't unify, it's just going to get worse and worse till this whole thing crumbles. But I'll just say, you got to love yourself, love your people, and begin. And it's very important to show love to people who you don't know, you know. Help people that you don't know. And stop always just thinking of yourself. It's when you do things for people that you don't know, that's what builds a better world.
That is true.
A lot of the good things that I do is because of good things that some white people did for me, you know, believe it or not. I've had white people that I didn't even know just out the blue do something for me when I was growing up, which caused me to just do stuff for people. When I'm doing stuff for strangers, usually it comes from what a Latino man did for me and what a white woman did for me.
All right.
It made me want to pay that type of energy forward. So sometimes you got to reach out to your brothers, and instead of trying to rob them, give them something, you know?
All right. Thank you for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler.
Anytime, Angela.
Have a good night.
Thank you for having me. You take care.
Grateful for God's blood.
Tell him about it, man.
Oh, the blood that saved me, the blood that raised me, the blood that healed me.
Yes. Listen.
Thank you for the blood.
The blood that saved
the
my
blood
life.
That saved my life.
And thank you for the Lamb.
Thank you.